Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Gordon Fellas. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Today our program visits Portland for a lecture and discussion on the crisis in Yemen. Will Picard, Executive Director of the Yemen Peace Project, is the speaker. He'll discuss the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, the role of the U.S., and what can be done to address the matter. Here giving introductory remarks is Brian Milikowski of Citizens Initiative Maine for Yemen.
My name is Brian Milikowski. I'm with Citizens Initiative Maine for Yemen. And today we're welcoming Will Picard of the Yemen Peace Project to speak to us about Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe, U.S. foreign policy, and what we as voters can do about it. The Yemen Peace Project was founded in 2011. By Will, in response to unconstrained anti-terrorist operations by the United States in Yemen, which had severe impacts on that country's civilian population. Will himself was in Yemen for the first time in 1999, returned in 2009 to study the conflicts between the Yemeni government and the Houthi forces that are also at play today, as Will will explain, and then in 2011 founded the Yemen Peace Project. He'll tell you more about his organization, and with that, we will begin our talk today. Thank you.
Thanks so much for that introduction, Brian. I appreciate it, and thanks for arranging this talk. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to connect with some grassroots activists and interested folk here in Maine. As Brian said, I founded the YPP, the Yemen Peace Project, almost 8 years ago in response to the death and destruction that U.S. counterterrorism operations were causing in Yemen. These days, we've expanded our focus a bit because the destructive role of U.S. policy in Yemen has expanded. Right now, most of our work is related to the ongoing war in Yemen and the resulting humanitarian crisis. Today, we'll talk about what the U.S. is doing in Yemen right now and what we can do to transform the U.S.-Yemen relationship for better. Before 1990, Yemen was actually two separate states, but even then, it was still both of those states were at the bottom of the list as far as GDP and other indicators within the Arab world. Yemen is still the poorest country in the Arab world. Right now, Yemen is embroiled in an internationalized civil war, which has transformed what was already a humanitarian danger zone into what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian disaster. To understand why this is happening, I'd like to give you a little bit of background on where this war came from and what the US and other powers are doing to perpetuate it. In the 1990s, a movement began in the northern highlands of Yemen, led by Zaydi Shia religious scholars who saw the marginalization of their faith and of their leaders. In 2004, they took up arms against the central government of Yemen to gain a voice in national affairs and more autonomy within their home region. The Al-Houthi family was at the heart of this movement, and soon the Yemeni press began to refer to the movement as the Houthi movement. In 2007, it's worth noting that at the opposite end of the country, in South Yemen, a movement was coalescing to demand autonomy and eventually independence for southern Yemen, which formerly was an independent state. The government in Sana'a, the capital, cracked down very hard on both of these movements. And in the north, the Houthi rebellion led to 6 years of war between the movement and the central government. Yemen in the 2000s had an extremely weak state and a strong central regime. The military of the country was divided between the family of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who ruled Yemen for 33 years, and a powerful general called Ali Mohsen, who was a relative of President Saleh but also a rival. Ali Mohsen is also a leading figure in Yemen's Sunni Islamist field and an agent of Saudi Arabia inside Yemen. The war in the 2000s was essentially more of a conflict between the Houthis and Ali Mohsen than between the Houthis and President Saleh in a strange way. By 2010, there was an uneasy peace in the north between the government and the Houthis, but a year later in 2011, a popular peaceful uprising began throughout the country as part of the regional Arab Spring. The Houthis joined the movement, this revolutionary movement, to oust President Saleh in the hopes of gaining more power in the eventual political settlement. The revolution eventually led to Saleh handing power to his vice president, Abdurrabu Mansur Hadi, and the creation of a transitional government and a national dialogue process in Yemen. The Houthis during this time sort of recreated themselves as a populist movement, and they gained considerable urban as well as rural support across the country, but they won no formal power through the transition process at all. In 2014, the transitional government released its draft constitution and a new plan for dividing Yemen into six federal states. The Houthis were not happy with this arrangement, and they organized massive protests in the capital city, Sana'a, while the military wing of the Houthi movement conducted a series of attacks in the north of Yemen against military units and tribal militias that were affiliated with its rivals. This was the start of a very slow-motion coup that eventually brought the Houthis and former President Saleh, their former enemy, into power in the capital. In late 2014, the Houthi fighters, along with pro-Saleh military units, entered the capital and seized control of government buildings and destroyed all military bases belonging to their rival, General Ali Mohsen. Eventually, the Houthis and current President Hadi negotiated a settlement which would form a new transitional government with a prime minister of the Houthis' choosing, essentially. The resulting government was actually, on paper, probably the best government that Yemen has ever had, but it wasn't allowed to do anything because the Houthis and Saleh loyalists and the current Hadi regime prevented their efforts. In January 2015, the Houthis placed President Hadi and his ministers under house arrest, and they formed their own provisional government in the capital. Eventually, President Hadi escaped to the southern city of Aden, from where he went on to Saudi Arabia, as the Houthi and Saleh forces launched offensives to take over different parts of the country as well as the capital. In March of 2015, then, Saudi Arabia assembled a coalition of Arab states and intervened in the war on behalf of President Hadi, who had been ousted by the Houthis. This began with a ferocious air campaign, from the very beginning caused a huge number of civilian casualties and targeted Yemen's civil infrastructure as well as military installations. In July, the southern resistance forces, backed by the Saudis and the UAE, retook the southern city of Aden from the Houthis and started trying to push the Houthis further north again. These southern resistance forces, though, that are fighting the Houthis are actually led by southern secessionists who do not plan to support a unified country after the war is over. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition continues to impose an illegal naval blockade as well as a blockade on Yemen's airports so that very little humanitarian aid and almost no commercial shipments are allowed into the country. So because of all of this, Yemen is now the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Out of a population of 27 million people right now, 7 million are on the brink of starvation, and 17 million more face food insecurity. Right now, over 3 million Yemenis have been displaced from their homes by fighting. That's more than 10% of the country displaced. And with most of the country's medical facilities destroyed, lacking in fuel and electricity, and a continuing blockade on medical imports, people are suffering and dying by the thousands from diseases that should be preventable. More than 500,000 Yemenis have contracted cholera this year. And according to the UN, a child in Yemen dies every 10 minutes from an easily treatable disease. Government employees, adding to the economic and humanitarian crisis, have not been paid their salaries in more than a year. About 25% of all Yemenis depend on a government salary in some respect. Right now, two-thirds of Yemenis require some kind of humanitarian assistance, and most of them are not getting it. So that's a big picture overview of the humanitarian situation. But I know it's sort of hard to really grasp these horrific numbers, so I'm going to take it down to the ground level a little bit. In the capital, Sana'a, I have a friend we'll call Fatima. In that city, more than 35% of all residents have seen their family homes destroyed by airstrikes. Fatima works in a government ministry. She was there before the Houthis' coup, and she remained in her position like most civil servants did. But the new Houthi management of her ministry prevents the employees from doing any actual work whatsoever, not unlike the way that our American State Department officers are now constrained by their superiors or lack thereof. The Houthis have also, in Sana'a, arrested or disappeared thousands of ordinary citizens like Fatima, so that government officials but also average citizens are afraid to speak out in any way against their rule. She hasn't received her salary in more than a year, almost a year and a half at this point. She has a chronic medical condition which requires daily medication, and if she can find a pharmacy that has drugs, she can't buy them because she has no salary. On top of that, she's supporting a friend who was displaced from her home after it was bombed, a single mother with no income. Outside their apartment, the streets of Sana'a are filled with garbage because nobody has been paid to collect it in more than a year. There's no municipal water supply, so Fatima and her neighbors have to go to a public well to collect their water, which is often contaminated by sewage. And every single day in the capital, the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes rumble over the city and drop bombs on civilian homes. And Fatima is actually one of the lucky ones. Most people in Sana'a have it much worse than her, an employed middle-class resident. In Yemen's most populous city, the city of Taiz, in the center of the country, one of our contacts tells me that some days the sound of coalition airplanes and the bombs that they drop is essentially a constant roar, preventing people in the city from having a moment's rest. And if there is a moment where the bombs aren't falling, Houthi artillery shells are raining down on markets, homes, and streets. When residents of Taiz, like my friend, venture outside, they go in fear of Houthi snipers who target civilians at random, and armed men who take advantage of the chaos to rob and extort. The Houthis control part of the city and maintain a full blockade on all of the city's entry points. They control the water and the electricity supply, which they cut off long ago. Occasionally, they will allow a relief truck carrying water or medicine into the city, but very rarely. And otherwise, the people of Taiz have to rely on footpaths through the steep mountains around the city and bring supplies in on their own backs or on donkeys. In the city of Hodeidah, on the Red Sea coast of Yemen, in the west of the country, a Yemeni journalist friend tells me about a similarly desperate situation. Before the war, he lived in the capital, Sana'a, and worked as a freelance journalist. When the airstrikes began in 2015, he sent his wife and his daughter to live with relatives in Hodeidah, far from the capital. But he followed them shortly thereafter once he figured out that the threat of arrest or assassination outweighed the meager salary he could make as a freelance reporter. In Hodeidah, robbery and violent crime are rampant now with no security. The fishing and farming that kept the province alive have been almost eliminated by the war. And the city's seaport, upon which 70% of all Yemenis depend, has been bombed by the Saudi-led coalition into almost inoperability. Right now, the coalition, as I mentioned, maintains a blockade of that seaport as well. So while humanitarian and commercial shipments literally sit offshore, Yemenis are dying and are on the edge of starvation across the province. Airstrikes are very common. Cholera and dengue fever are even more so. There are, of course, dozens of local and international organizations that are doing everything they can to relieve the crisis in Yemen. And it's absolutely critical that the U.S. and other foreign countries continue to fund those humanitarian efforts. But the truth is that humanitarian aid is never going to be enough. It's not in any conflict enough to replace what's lost. And the bottom line is that the humanitarian crisis is going to continue to get worse the longer this war goes on, and there will be no real relief and no reconstruction of Yemen until the war ends. Back in 2014, when the Houthis began their slow-motion coup, the UN Secretary General appointed a special envoy to help the Houthis and the Hadi government reach some sort of political settlement. Once the civil war began in earnest, the UN special envoy became the point man for the UN's peace process in Yemen. Since then, unfortunately, both the legitimate Yemeni government of President Hadi and the Houthi Saleh camp have accused the special envoy of bias and have dragged their feet on implementing any part of the peace process. Every day they do so, and every day the international community fails to pressure both parties to move forward, more Yemenis die waiting for peace. So let's talk a little bit about America's role in this conflict then. When Saudi Arabia began its airstrikes, began its intervention into Yemen in March 2015, they did so without the foreknowledge of the Obama administration. In the days that followed, the U.S. agreed to provide logistical and intelligence support for the coalition, and this took a few different forms. First of all, the U.S. Air Force provided and continues to provide in-air and on-the-ground refueling for coalition warplanes. The U.S. also allowed the coalition to use its air base in Djibouti until the Emiratis and the Saudis could build their own bases in Africa. U.S. Navy ships participated in the early phase of the blockade of Yemeni seaports in contrary to U.S. and international law. And American officers were deployed to the coalition's Joint Command Center to assist with targeting and planning of airstrikes. Furthermore, the U.S. ramped up arms sales to Saudi Arabia and to other coalition states. And for the first year or so of the war, the Obama administration's support for the coalition essentially amounted to a blank check. In fact, the Obama administration had an informal agreement with Saudi Arabia that, in exchange for the Saudis signing off on the Iran nuclear deal, which they opposed vociferously, they could do whatever they wanted to in Yemen. But Obama and his government did try in a very limited way to lobby the Saudis to avoid civilian casualties where possible. The State Department gave the Saudis a list, a no-strike list of humanitarian sites. The Saudis ignored that list with impunity until October 2016 when they bombed a funeral in Sana'a deliberately with U.S.-provided munitions. The Obama administration responded by pulling most of U.S. personnel out of the Joint Command Center and freezing planned shipments of new bombs to Saudi Arabia. On the humanitarian front, under Obama, the U.S. was the largest single donor to the UN's humanitarian response plan. And the U.S. also provided funds to buy new cranes to replace those destroyed in the seaport of Hodeidah. The Saudis, thus far, have not allowed those cranes to reach the port and be installed. And while the U.S. gave humanitarian assistance, it also froze all of its long-term development projects in Yemen. And it has failed repeatedly to exert real pressure on the coalition to allow more relief to enter the country or to stop bombing medical and other humanitarian facilities. Under the previous administration, though, sort of paradoxically, the U.S. was a leading sponsor of the UN peace process. Secretary of State Kerry made Yemen his own private mission. And he and the U.S. ambassador to Yemen spent a lot of time meeting with all the different parties to the conflict and trying to move the peace process forward. Unfortunately, he didn't succeed during his term. Under the Trump administration, all of the positive aspects of U.S. involvement in Yemen have been reversed. Humanitarian donations that were promised by the Obama administration are going forward, but the White House is trying to zero out the foreign assistance budget for the coming years. And Secretary of State Tillerson has done nothing whatsoever to advance the peace process. The Trump administration has also given the Saudi-led coalition almost unfettered military support. They've increased the U.S. presence in the Joint Command Center again. They've ramped up refueling operations for coalition warplanes. And Trump also planned to support a coalition offensive against the city of Hodeidah, which would have cut off the trickle of aid and imports that keep the Yemeni people alive. That offensive would have gone forward with U.S. support had our Congress not intervened and forced the president to back down. Trump has also unfrozen arms sales to Saudi Arabia and sped some of them up, signaling to the coalition that there will be no consequences whatsoever for killing civilians. And Trump administration officials have also accepted and perpetuated the narrative that is pushed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that says that the war against the Houthis is actually a war against Iran. And many within Trump's Defense Department and the National Security Council right now are eager to confront Iran and see Yemen as the place to do it. That means that U.S. involvement in Yemen right now risks pulling the U.S. and all of the countries of the region into a much larger regional war that would be utterly disastrous. So I've painted a bleak picture, but Yemen's survival, in my opinion, is not yet a lost cause. The U.S. and the international community can pressure the warring parties to allow aid and commerce into Yemen. The U.S. can pressure the coalition and the Hadi government to participate in the peace process in good faith. And the U.S. can increase its own humanitarian efforts and help to formulate a post-war reconstruction plan. The Yemen Peace Project is the only U.S. advocacy organization that focuses entirely on Yemen. We are working every day to end the war, to strengthen the humanitarian response, and to hold all parties accountable for their unlawful conduct in Yemen. This year, our organization has organized and led a coalition of human rights, humanitarian, and advocacy organizations, including Oxfam, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and some others, to drive congressional engagement on Yemen in Washington. Since January, our small advocacy team has built strong relationships with about 30 offices in the Senate and 25 members of the House of Representatives, and our congressional advocacy efforts this year have had a real impact. Earlier this year, when the U.S. administration, as I said, was poised to escalate the war with an assault on Hodeidah, we convinced Congress, members of Congress in both houses and on both sides of the aisle, to pressure the administration to back down. In March, dozens of members of Congress signed a letter to the White House demanding immediate action to prevent famine in Yemen. And in April, senators introduced bipartisan resolutions calling for an urgent and comprehensive diplomatic effort to end the war and the humanitarian crisis. In May, at our urging, members of both the House and the Senate introduced legislation that would block the planned sale of precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia. These bombs have been used against civilians repeatedly, and we know that for a fact. The YPP and our allies were able to win 47 votes in the Senate in favor of stopping the arms sales, which is the closest that the Senate has come to blocking an arms sale since the Reagan administration. In July, we wrote four amendments to the House National Defense Authorization Act, which is part of the annual defense budget in the U.S. These amendments would limit U.S. involvement in Yemen in a few different ways. We successfully lobbied members of the House to support amendments that would prohibit U.S. military operations and prohibit U.S. troops from being deployed to the conflict in Yemen. And in addition to working to end U.S. involvement in the war, we're also lobbying the State Department now to support the creation of an independent mechanism to investigate violations of international law in Yemen. And in the meantime, we're tracking those violations ourselves with an eye toward post-war transitional justice efforts. And we're making sure that officials in the administration and in Congress have all of the information that they need by providing them with regular news updates and analysis of affairs in Yemen. So that leads me to the most important question, which is what everyone in this room can do to end this war and relieve the world's most severe humanitarian disaster. As I said above, U.S. pressure can produce a peace agreement, and a peace agreement can allow humanitarian relief to begin in earnest. So first of all, your members of Congress need to hear from you about Yemen. There's already a surprising level of congressional interest in the situation there, but members are not always sure how to be helpful. They are lobbied constantly by the White House, by the Saudis, and by the Emiratis, and they need to hear other expert input, and they need to hear the will of their constituents as well. One of the ways that you can help us reach your members of Congress and your senators is to sign up for our action alerts. Congress right now has an unprecedented opportunity to shape foreign policy because of the situation in the White House and the State Department. We need to help them do so. When Congress is considering actions on Yemen, we send out call scripts and letter templates that people can use to automatically contact their representatives. We also, if you want to schedule meetings with congressional staff here in Maine, as Brian has done already, we will provide talking points and advice for those meetings. And we urge you to attend town halls, and we'll provide questions to be asked at town halls wherever possible. And finally, you can also support the Yemen Peace Project so we can continue to do this valuable advocacy on U.S. policy. Our work is only possible because of the donations of people like you, and we really need your help to keep going. So I hope that you'll consider making a gift to the Yemen Peace Project, which you can do at yemenpeaceproject.org. And while there, you can sign up for our newsletters, which go out every week, and our action alerts, which go out as needed. We'd really appreciate your support. So with that, I'd love to take your questions on the situation in Yemen and on U.S. policy and what U.S. citizens can do now.
Are you saying the Obama administration backed the wrong side?
No. The Obama administration... Oh, sorry. Did the Obama administration back the wrong side? I don't believe so. I don't believe the Obama administration should have involved the U.S. in this war at all. I think that the Obama administration, and as I said, especially Secretary Kerry, were absolutely right to jump in to humanitarian response and to diplomatic efforts. But making the U.S. a party to the conflict by supporting the coalition, not only is it wrong, but it puts American personnel at liability for war crimes in Yemen, essentially. It means that our American fuel, bombs, and personnel are responsible for killing civilians in another country, which is not something that the U.S. should be involved in. I absolutely do not think that the U.S. or anyone else should be supporting the Houthi movement or former President Saleh. But the way to deal with this is to be a force, a positive diplomatic force and a positive humanitarian force, and help to get these parties toward a peace agreement, which really is possible with enough diplomatic work.
Can you tell us about our two Maine senators and where they've voted?
Great. About the two senators in Maine and where they stand on this. Senator King has been helpful so far. Thanks to Brian and others who have asked him questions about Yemen at local events here in Maine. He has signed, he voted the right way on our resolution to block an arms sale to Saudi Arabia, and he's made a couple of personal statements in person about the situation. We'd really like him to be more active and more public with his positions on the situation in Yemen. I think that his staff in Washington might be holding him back a little bit. But if we can sort of turn him from voting the right way into being a consistent ally on Yemeni affairs, that would be really helpful. Senator Collins voted against the measure to block the arms sale. This is not really a party line issue, though. We had Republicans co-sponsor the bill. We had Republicans vote for it, and we had five Democrats vote against, unfortunately. I don't think that there's any reason why any Republican senator should be sort of a natural opponent to us on this stuff, because we're not pushing a partisan agenda. And I'm hoping that in the future, engaged Mainers can help us reach Collins and sort of get her to pay attention to the human rights implications, the humanitarian and the international law implications of this war, and come out on the right side.
Will, could you give us a sense of what is happening right now in Congress, questions that are before our senators and representatives right now that affect Yemen?
Great question. So what issues are facing Congress right now regarding Yemen? The big thing that we're working on right this second is, the National Defense Authorization Act. So that's the part of the annual defense budget. The House has passed its version of that bill. The Senate is going to take it up as soon as they come back from recess next week. And when they do, we've already prepared amendments matching those that we passed on the House side. And we have sponsors in the Senate pushing those forward. So we're going to be focusing a lot of our effort on making sure that those amendments get passed, and then that all of these amendments make it through the conference process where the two houses hash out a final version of the budget, of the defense budget. So that's one of the main things we're on right now. Another important thing, given that the UN General Assembly and the UN Human Rights Commission meet in September, we and a big coalition of NGOs around the world are pushing for, again, the creation of an independent mechanism to investigate violations of humanitarian law in Yemen. That's something that you need. It's something that exists in Syria because the international community agreed that it had to exist. And we need it in Yemen desperately. Unfortunately, the last time that question came up at the UN, the US and the UK blocked the creation of such a mechanism. The Dutch delegation to the UN is leading that, the call for an amendment or a resolution that would create that body right now. So we're working really hard with the State Department, with our contacts there, and with our European allies as well to make sure that this time, at the very least, the U.S. will abstain and will not block that mechanism from being created.
Why do you think the U.S. and the Brits did block that?
The U.S. and the Brits blocked the effort to create a joint a investigatory mechanism because, essentially, the Saudis and the Emiratis asked them to, which is... It's a really tricky question. I mean, the Saudis understand full well what they're doing in Yemen and what the civilian cost is it and what and the legal ramifications to it. But they also know that it's almost impossible in international law to really enforce these things, to enforce war crimes rulings. And if you just prevent the credible investigation of them, they'll eventually go away. We're doing all that we can to collect evidence and testimony, not just of civilian casualties and destruction caused by the Saudi-led coalition, but also of crimes committed by the Houthis and by former President Saleh's people. And part of the reason we're doing that, besides the fact that it's something that needs to get done, is so that we can present these cases to the Yemeni government and to its backers in Saudi Arabia and say, look, you're preventing the investigation and the prosecution of these things, these crimes being committed against Yemen. This isn't just about you guys. So we're hoping that we'll have a stronger case. We are in regular touch with five different bureaus in the State Department, and several of them are really sympathetic toward this issue and would like to see an investigatory mechanism. But the State Department, unfortunately, doesn't really lead in terms of making policy right now. The White House and the Defense Department really have the final say on these things, so we're hoping that we can find a way forward. We're getting signals that it's possible that the U.S. will abstain on this vote, which would be good. If we could get them to support it, that would be outstanding, but it's not particularly likely. Sir, in the back.
I'm sorry I came in late, but I have sort of a general question. It's kind of a question that has to do with prevention, which, of course, is always worth considering possible. Best I can tell, really have been precious few successful prosecutions of war crimes. You think of the former Yugoslavia, some of the stuff that went on there, and then one or two places in sub-Saharan Africa where they actually went and they got these people. But it was years after the crime, and it looked like it involved a lot of effort to do it, and it's amazing that they were actually successful. My question is, are we at a point now where the bad actors see that and say, oh my God, I better not raise this village because 20 years from now I may end up in the Hague or someplace. You understand my question?
Yeah.
And I feel whether it's something that's really evolving and has a future or whether we're still just kind of shooting in the dark with it.
Right. So does precedence in international law prosecution affect the way that actors in these conflicts behave in some way? That is a tricky question, and there's so many different possible venues that international law can be pursued in. Where it's been successful, you've got the tribunal model, like the former Yugoslavia, where a special tribunal is set up, and the country in question plays a part in arresting and bringing these people to justice. And then you have the sort of external jurisdiction model, where somebody like the UK issues an arrest warrant on Pinochet or on somebody from an African country and eventually is able to bring them in or not. We have a really important example from the recent history as well, which is Libya, where there's sort of, if a country does not sign on to the law that establishes the International Criminal Court and create jurisdiction that way, The other way a case can get referred to the International Criminal Court is if the UN Security Council refers it. So with Libya, that was the case. The UN Security Council did that. And the court has been able to build cases against several people from the former Gaddafi regime who were involved in crimes against humanity. And they're struggling now to get those individuals handed over by the militias in Libya that still hold them to an international force of some sort. So I think that, in part, parties to a conflict like the one in Yemen right now look at the precedents and they say there's very little risk of anything bad happening to me. They also have their own example. In 2011, when there was finally an agreement for the longtime dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh to hand over power to the new president, Hadi, part of that agreement stipulated that Saleh and all of his people would be immune from prosecution inside Yemen. So that's sort of an example. They have these things nudging them toward, no, you're probably never going to come to justice. But on the other side, both parties really do care about how they're viewed internationally. The Saudis have worked really hard to get their names off of blacklists for stuff like killing children and oppressing women. So they care about their international reputation. The rebels do as well. And to some extent, if these crimes are publicized, if cases and evidence are made public, it does sometimes constrain their actions a bit. It really does. But I think why an investigatory body in Yemen is so important is so that we can make sure that all of this is preserved. It's going to be a long time before Yemeni courts are able to prosecute this stuff just because of the state of the country right now, but international courts can start to work on ways. Our organization is pushing the Security Council also to refer Yemen to the International Criminal Court like it did with Libya because the local courts are not equipped to handle this stuff at all. So that's sort of part of our efforts and part of the recommendations that we make when it comes to the peace process as well. Did you have another question?
Yeah, could you say a bit about Iran's role in this and why we're supporting Saudi Arabia?
What is Iran's role in the conflict? Thanks for asking. I mean, I've given a 30-minute talk on Yemen, and I used the word Iran like twice, which is not the sense you would get if you read press coverage of the conflict. It's usually said that the Houthis are a proxy for Iran in Yemen. I say that that's not the case. What is the case is that the Houthis have ties to the Iranian regime. They receive a little bit of money, some small arms, these days some bigger stuff as well, from the Iranians to use in Yemen. But the Iranians don't call the shots. They in fact counseled the Houthis not to take the capital in 2014. That was not something Iran wanted to see. And the Houthis did it anyway. They do things for their own local Yemeni reasons. And the Iran card has been played by the Yemeni government and by the Saudis and the U.S. for a long time. Back to 2004, when the Houthis and the government first started fighting in the far north, the regime would say these are Iranian actors, and that was blatantly untrue. There was no funding whatsoever at that point. What happens, though, is that the longer the war goes on, who do the Houthis have to turn to for money and guns? They have very few places that they can go. So Iran becomes more and more their supplier and their supporter the longer the war goes on. And regionally, if Iran looks at the U.S. and sees that the U.S. is escalating its support for the Saudi-led coalition, then that encourages Iran to escalate its support for the Houthis. So instead of a process of de-escalation, we're trapped in this sort of escalation loop right now, which the U.S. could avoid. And I think really, if you want to get Iran out of Yemen, the way to do it is to end the war, because that's the only influence they have is through this war whatsoever. So if you end the war and reach a Yemeni peace settlement involving all of the parties and all of the factions in Yemen, Iran is excluded from that. They won't get what they want. They've already given up a lot of their sort of the funding that they do for forces around the world, little external projects that they have. They've given up because of diplomatic efforts, not because of military efforts. So you're not going to beat Iran and Yemen. You're only going to strengthen their hand there if you continue to prosecute that war.
When I think of peace process, first thing that comes to mind is Korea and Vietnam in the 50s. When I think of ending a war, I think of Germany, Japan, victory and defeat. Mm-hmm. At least, finally, there was victory in Vietnam in 1975. That was a lot of years. Just having a peace process here is going to keep this place a third world hellhole for another 50 years. Whoever the bad guy is, once you hang them, you know, you can put an end to the war. They have to give up. The quicker that's done, then you can get back to having a growing, you know, culture in this area. But a peace process, I don't like the sound of it.
So you're saying that there should be a military solution rather than a negotiated one to the war?
It's nothing like one side saying, we give up, and then I think history has shown that, in general, tensions are gone.
So I would argue a few things. First of all, there aren't any good guys in this war. There's obviously the side that the U.S. supports and the other side.
Governments have interests.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also, according to everything that I see, and this has also been backed up by the UN's panel of experts on Yemen in their recent reports, it's just not likely that there's going to be a military victory by either side. Nothing unconditional. Nobody's going to surrender unconditionally in this conflict. It's not going to happen. What you will have, as it continues, is different mini wars breaking out under this big civil war. So eventually the Houthis and Saleh are going to war against each other. Eventually the various factions in the south are going to war against each other. This could be just sort of an all-out war involving 20 different factions instead of three or four like it does right now. That is a likely evolution of the conflict without a diplomatic process. Unconditional surrender and total military victory is almost certainly not going to happen. The Yemeni regime, the prior regime, fought the Houthis for 6 years and never beat them. The Saudi army entered that war as well in 2009 and got beaten. The Houthis have gained territory in Saudi Arabia through this current war. They haven't lost their place along the border. None of that is positive. None of that is taking us toward an end game, unfortunately.
Are these two different versions of Islam fighting?
So is this a sectarian conflict, essentially? The Houthis are Zaydi. They are members of a Shia minority. But in this conflict, and I would argue in most conflicts, it's not a conflict because of sectarianism. Rather, sectarianism has entered Yemen because of the conflict. When you have warring parties, they find identifiers. They find something to distinguish the other. And in Yemen, sectarianism has never been a feature of politics or public life until this war began. So it is becoming a sectarian war. That's not the cause of the war.
Why are they fighting? What's the basic argument?
The basic argument is the Houthis want more national power and more local control in their own sort of home region. They weren't going to get that through the new federal plan that the 2014 Constitution introduced. They were going to be cut off from the sea. They want sort of a little autonomous statelet in the north with maritime access. That's sort of the clearest way I can put what their interest is. In truth, though, the Houthis have been really bad at articulating their demands, and Secretary Kerry sat in a room with the Houthi leadership in 2014, and basically asked them what they needed, what were their sort of minimum asks in this conflict, and they couldn't really articulate that to him. They're not an experienced political body. They're an experienced fighting body. What they do is they fight for more power, and what the government does historically in Yemen is crack down against anyone who opposes it. This has gotten just that same process, but magnified 100-fold, and neither side really knows what to do other than to rebel and repress. They don't know exactly how to move beyond that. The government doesn't know what a face-saving option out of this war is, unfortunately, and the Houthis as well. They're also being spurred on more and more by former President Saleh, who wants nothing other than his own personal control of Yemen to be restored, and he's going to support whatever factions, whatever provocations he needs to do to get there.
Would you describe this as tribal if it's not sectarian?
No, though there are tribes on both sides, but neither side is run by a tribal interest. Tribes are part of the social makeup of Yemen. They align themselves differently with different groups.
So are there two separate groups of tribes fighting each other? Or is it brother against brother? Yeah, that sounds a stretch.
It really is. I mean, you'll find certain tribes in the north where half of the membership is fighting for the government and half is fighting for the Houthis. It's not that way. And partly because tribes in Yemen have always been a strong social feature, but they're not sub-states. They're not, like, easily distinct polities that fight each other. It's a little bit more complicated. And I totally understand what you're saying, but I don't want to go into like an hour-long talk about tribal history in Yemen because everyone would be really bored by that after a while. But yeah, it is hard to sort of figure out where these fault lines are, and it's hard for the parties to know as well. Right now you have the Emiratis and the Saudis competing for control in the south through their own proxies, even though they're on the same side. And, you know, Qatar was on their side as well until a few days ago, and now there's this big feud between the Saudis and Qatar. And so it's really messy. And it's only going to get messier, I think, the longer the fighting goes on. It's not going to sort of boil down into an easily winnable war. That's my take.
Are the Chinese involved in any way? I mean, they really are reaching out in the world to do a lot of things in a lot of different places. Some of it seems pretty good, actually. I mean, obviously they've got their agenda. Yeah. But I mean, I'm wondering, is it just too hot and dangerous there for them to even be interested in doing, or are they a possible force to help things forward?
So what is China's involvement in the conflict?
Yeah.
Thus far, virtually none. They've really stayed out of this. They have put out the same kind of statements that any foreign government puts out around tragedies and atrocities committed in Yemen. They say this is bad. They call for all sides to engage in the peace process. Just very anodyne stuff. They're not picking a side and they're not playing a role. In Yemen, the Chinese have long made small infrastructure and humanitarian investments, but they haven't been a major player and they haven't done the sort of stuff that they do, for instance, in some African states where they're really trying to build their brand and to build up some loyalty there. That really hasn't been their play in Yemen thus far. And I know Brian wants to say a few words about organizing for Yemen here in Maine, so I'm going to let him take over, and then if we have some time, feel free to grab me with additional questions. Thanks so much for having me today.
Yes, I would like to mention that we were able to invite Will today on behalf of the Citizens Initiative, called Maine for Yemen. This is just beginning. To be quite honest, right now it's a small number of enthusiasts, primarily focused on communicating to our members of Congress about present U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia and towards Yemen, and trying to build a constituency for a much better policy within our state. I think we have a unique opportunities in Maine as a state with a very small population to reach out directly to our senators. And they have both engaged with this issue. As Will mentioned, Angus King occasionally can be caught on record on this issue. This spring he spoke at Colby College, and I had the chance to ask him about United States support for Saudi Arabia, and he gave a strikingly strong answer. He said, I think it's a mistake. I think we need a major rethinking of our policy because we can't be complicit. We can't pretend we didn't know what the jet fuel was being used for. That's only a slight paraphrasing of Senator King's words. So we believe that further outreach, both to Senators King and Collins, can turn a senator like Angus King, as Will said, from someone who's right now voting well to an active supporter and champion of human rights in Yemen. And we also believe outreach is necessary to our congresspeople. Shelley Pingree, who's been extremely strong on this issue, positive, signed the congressional letter to the president, and to Bruce Poliquin, who thus far has not taken any public position on this issue. We're just beginning. We're just developing a strategy for this organization. We really hope people hearing this presentation might be interested in participating. We have a group on Facebook, Maine for Yemen, maineforyemen@gmail.com. Thank you.
And you can email me at will@YemenPeaceProject anytime if you have other questions or just want some more information about how to get involved.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Will Picard, Executive Director of the Yemen Peace Project on Speaking in Maine, here on Maine Public Radio. This program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where you can find Speaking in Maine both for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine on Maine Public, I'm Gordon Fellis.